House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is June 1st, 2015. We will be carrying over Senate Bill 315. We will be carrying over Senate Bill 641, and we will be carrying over Senate Bill 913. We will open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 525.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 525B prohibits the possession of a firearm or ammunition if a respondent is subject to a restraining order protecting an intimate partner or child of an intimate partner issued or continued after a respondent had actual notice and an opportunity to be heard. It applies the prohibition if a person has been convicted of a misdemeanor involving domestic violence that has use or attempted use of physical force or use or threatened use of a deadly weapon as an element of the offense, and the defendant was a family member of the victim at the time of the offense. It establishes definitions for family member, intimate partner, and conviction. The bill states that the prohibition does not apply if the offense is expunged and allows relief from prohibition upon court petition. We do have Dash B6 amendments before us which resolve a conflict, a potential conflict between House Bill 2429 and Senate Bill 525B. There is a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact on the B and gross version, and it's ready to move today.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Peluso, could you come up as well? With the panel? Please go ahead, Attorney General.
Oh, could I go first?
Yes, you could.
I'm deferring to the senator, Mr. Chair.
I have to chair a committee.
Okay.
And the Attorney General said.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and parts of East Portland. And I'm so happy to bring to you Senate Bill 525. It has been worked extensively on the Senate side with the Republican caucus, the Democratic caucus, certain members in particular, Steve Elzinaga and Anna Braun, working to get a consensus where the NRA and the Federation are standing neutral, and I'm very pleased with the product, and I will let the others go into more detail.
Okay, thank you for coming over.
And I'll defer to another senator, if I might.
Thank you. I'm State Senator Jackie Winters, representing District 10. And I, too, am supporting Senate Bill 525. The Senate Bill 525 comes to you with a lot of collaboration and work between the Senate Republican office and the Democrat office. And I need to go back because originally I was not on the sponsorship of this bill. And I said if we're able to work the bill to where NRA and the Oregon Arms Federation will be neutral, then I would give consideration. Following all the work that's been done by the two offices and, you know, those individuals who have worked in good faith and provided the input to bring forth Senate Bill 525, I then agreed to become a part of the bill. I was the carrier closing on the bill to encourage my colleagues over in the Senate to support it. And I believe that passing this law takes an important step forward to ensure for the first time that there is state authority for our law enforcement. And by the way, our enforcement partners actually welcome this bill. And you need to understand Senate Bill 525 does not exceed federal standards. If anything, it aligns, and it's probably about a step lower. And it's that for those reasons that, you know, I and others of my colleagues have voted in favor of this. I want to point out that for my county, and I would suggest that others go check their counties and ask their district attorneys and their law enforcement community what has occurred inside of their county with respect to domestic violence and firearms. In my particular county, for example, I learned that in 2013, five people died in a domestic violence incident here in Salem. And that two of those individuals were children. And I know, like most of us, we're all concerned about what happens, you know, where children and things happen. And it was interesting to me to also note that here in Salem in 2014, if you kept up with what was going on in our local newspaper, there was an individual that was shot and killed in her home. So, you know, when we began to look at this particular issue, and we began to realize that what we're doing actually parallels with federal statutes and also provides the giving authority to our own law enforcement community. And it was for those reasons that I believe that we need to go forward in Oregon. So we passed the statute out of the Senate on a 26-4 vote. And so I wanted to come and share that with you and ask you to join the good senators over in the other chamber.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum, and I'm the Attorney General for Oregon. And I come to you today in support of Senate Bill 525. And I want to thank our senators who have already spoken for their support of this bill. As Attorney General, I administer all parts of the Department of Justice, but I have a particular soft spot for the Crime Victim Services Division, which acts as the primary agency administering the grants and services upon which crime victims rely in their time of greatest need. This division also tracks many of the national issues which most significantly impact the victims of crime. And it is in this capacity that I come before you today to talk about the clear and unacceptable connection between gun violence and domestic abuse. In an average year, around 20% of all homicides are related to domestic violence. Approximately two-thirds of those homicides involve the use of a firearm. Nationwide, the risk of homicide is 20 times higher in homes where there is both an established history of domestic violence and ready access to guns. Domestic violence assaults with guns are 12 times more likely to be fatal than assaults without guns. But this tells only part of the story. Research shows that domestic abusers who possess guns tend to use them as part of their pattern of abuse, as a ready threat of further violence, and as a tool for psychological control and mistreatment. The domestic violence fatality statistics are shocking, but they cannot be allowed to overshadow the struggles of those who live under the constant shadow of firearm-related violence against themselves and their children. Federal law recognizes this danger by prohibiting individuals convicted of certain crimes of domestic violence or subject to qualifying restraining orders that have been upheld after a hearing from possessing guns and ammunition. Unfortunately, these federal protections are not codified in Oregon law. This means that Oregon courts have no specific statutory authority to implement these protections and no authority to hold abusers accountable for violations. Most concerning, victims in Oregon are left without the protection intended by the federal law. In the absence of local authority, the entire state of Oregon is left to rely on the 14 Oregon-based agents of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And while these agents do good work, it is simply unreasonable to expect this federal team, with many additional assignments, to shoulder this significant burden as well. Senate Bill 525B provides Oregon courts with the tools they need to protect the victims of domestic abuse and will provide state and local law enforcement with the power to enforce the prohibitions that up till now have only existed under federal law. I believe this bill represents a tremendous opportunity to protect the lives of the victims of domestic violence. I urge your support for Senate Bill 525B. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative, go ahead, and then we'll have any questions.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, and I am the representative from House District 50, which includes the great city of Gresham and a small portion of Southeast Portland. I am proud to have joined my colleagues in the Oregon State Legislature to chief sponsor Senate Bill 525, a bill that will protect women's lives by restricting their abusers' access to guns. This bill is an important one, and it is one I care very deeply about. Many of you know I worked in law enforcement for 30 years with the Gresham Police Department and was honored to serve as the police chief for my last 6 years. During my time in law enforcement, I worked on cases involving murder, rape, child abuse, and domestic violence. The domestic violence cases had a profound impact on me, and I knew I wanted to do more to protect the women and children that find themselves facing domestic violence. In the early 90s, I secured a federal grant and formed a special unit in Gresham dedicated solely to investigating domestic violence crimes. I wanted to make sure that not only were there trained detectives in the unit to put criminals behind bars, but advocates who could help victims recover from their abuse and bring their attackers to justice. As a police officer, I responded to way too many domestic violence-related calls. As a detective, I investigated way too many domestic violence-related deaths. As a hostage negotiator, I responded to domestic violence call-related CERT major crimes call-outs, where the typical scenario involved an abuser who had barricaded himself, the victim, and most often children. As a police lieutenant, I initiated and supervised the domestic violence reduction unit. As a police chief, I kept that unit staffed and funded for almost 6 years, but none of that prepared me for one of the worst crime scenes, a scene that never goes away. Out of respect for survivors in the room, I will be brief. I was a lieutenant working the graveyard shift, a call of shots fired, second story apartment, no additional information. The first two patrol cars arrived, gave out the exact location of the apartment. I mentioned that was a second story apartment. I mentioned the second story, as most often there are two flights of stairs that double back, which allows no concealment and can make the approach and entry into the apartment very dangerous. As approaching officers, you feel very vulnerable. The first two arriving officers, as they approached the front door, heard the sounds of screaming children, found the door unlocked, and opened the door at the same time a shotgun blast echoed everywhere. The screaming intensified. Officers called for Code 3 cover. Two more officers arrived, and there was no radio transmission for what seemed like an eternity. I believe I was the next to arrive, but to be honest, I'm not certain. Between adrenaline, stress, and fear, things get very blurry. But what I do remember is walking into the most horrific crime scene I have ever seen and that I will never forget. The first gunshot blast at close range took the life of the victim, a mother of two children. Those children were in the bed with their mother when she was killed. The second gunshot blast at close range was the cowardly act of the abuser taking his own life. I think this is enough information to make my point. Was there a restraining out on the abuser? Yes. Did the abuser have access to a shotgun? Apparently so. It is important to note that Senate Bill 525 is not a new concept. In the mid-90s, the Violence Against Women Act added these protections to federal law, and this bill means Oregon law will provide the same important protections. Senate Bill 525 will also go a long way in protecting our law enforcement officers who are responding to volatile situations. In fact, when police officers respond to a domestic violence call and firearms are present, the risk of harm to the police officers increases. In states where laws restricting access to guns by domestic violence offenders, there are significant decreases in domestic violence-related homicides, in some cases by nearly 20%. Bottom line, Senate Bill 525 will mean that those who have been determined to be perpetrators of domestic violence cannot possess firearms as a matter of state law. If a weapon is within the reach of an abuser, the risk of homicidal violence is extreme. This bill gives the criminal justice system a tool to directly reduce this risk and save lives. Thank you.
Questions? 10-1, I'm going to support the bill. But with all these gun bills we've heard, 941, you see the use of statistical information to justify the bill. The acts that are perpetrated on women or other victims, children, men, I think justify a lot of the bills. I believe in one of them, I said, women are 46% more likely to get killed in their home if there's a gun present. Well, of course, if the home that doesn't have a gun, no one's going to get killed with a gun. But what they didn't tell you is those women are strangled.
True.
And if you turn it around, because unfortunately, most of the time, it's men who are committing the violence, you know, percentage-wise. Do women strangle their husbands? Rarely, but what do? They shoot them. Or, what's the other one? They poison them. So you can turn this stuff around and use all these different statistics and things. We want to reduce violence. And at some point, this alone doesn't do it. We have to find out what are the causes of men and women. There's normally, your police, alcohol and drugs, huge percentage of the time. And addictions. And it becomes through the generations, those children saw it, took part in it, and they're going to be there in years to come. So someplace early interdiction into families, I think, could contribute a lot to slowing this type of activity down.
Mr. Chair, can I respond?
Yes, you can, please.
I couldn't agree with you more. We have to go so far to break these cycles of violence. But I said often as a police chief, a police officer, whatever, we have to do what we can now to disrupt that behavior, whatever steps we can take to end, to reach that goal that you're talking about. And I firmly believe one of those steps involves the lack of access to guns.
Okay. And I have a question for the Attorney General. So somebody's placed on a restraining order, and the judge says you no longer have firearms. When the restraining order is lifted, and I'm making another assumption here, once that order is entered, if that person would go to buy a gun and do a background check, they would be blocked. Once the restraining order is lifted, are they off that list, the restricted list?
I believe, Chair Barker, members of the committee, I believe so. Sybil Hebb is here with technical answers, and so I would want to make sure she agrees, but I think it is limited to the period during which the restraining order is in effect. After the hearing and after the person has appeared and had the opportunity to be heard, or if not appeared, actually have received the notice to appear.
Okay, thank you, Attorney General.
Yes.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Peluso, I got a question for you because of the scenario that you gave. It actually goes right to a question that I typed to myself about this. It's federal law now. The stories that I've read and the things that I've read about, it's rarely enforced now, what this bill addresses. I don't think it's being enforced enough. I'm afraid that, and I'm not trying to raise a problem here, but sort of the same situation with Senate Bill 941 in that the enforceability. I'm concerned about the enforceability. It's one thing to have a bill and make it law and rah-rah, but how does it actually stop the guns? And the reason I ask that is, in the scenario you gave, you went into a situation where the gun was there. This bill, I don't think, would have stopped that. Instead, what I'm afraid of is that, as a law enforcement person, you would have went in knocking on somebody's door, not knowing whether they had a gun or not, because you're there to search for a gun or firearm or ammunition. And to me, that puts you in a really dangerous situation. So to me, that's what scares me about this bill. It puts you in an even more dangerous situation because now you have no idea what you're going to meet.
Chair Barker and Representative Post, I mean, you make a very good point, but that's what I did every day. I put a uniform on.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, that's part of the job. So when we can, again, disrupt the opportunity for people to have that gun, if we backtrack, and that was also part of generally what the follow-up investigations was, to backtrack how those guns got into those individual hands to do exactly what you said, so we could learn and figure out how to reduce that even occurring in the first place.
One follow-up.
Please follow-up.
This is for Attorney General Rosamond. Thank you.
Certainly.
Appreciate it. Would this bill, if law, compel public safety personnel to confiscate firearms and ammunition from individuals who have never been charged or convicted of a crime, either felony or misdemeanor, and that they're only subject because of an accusation?
Chair Barker, Representative Post, if I understand you correctly, it would, the only people who, against whom it would be effective who have not been convicted of a crime would be someone who has an active restraining order against them, issued pursuant to Oregon law, of course, after a hearing for which the person had actual notice and during the course of which that person had an opportunity to be heard. So that person would not necessarily have a prior conviction or even a later conviction. But that person is obviously of extreme risk in the community due to an active restraining order that had to be established by law, by court.
I asked Sybil Hebb to come forward. Could you fill any of those pieces?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here. And I believe there have been two questions. To follow up on your question, Representative Post, I agree with the Attorney General. So the bill as drafted now, as a result of the compromise work, mirrors almost exactly the federal law. And the federal law applies to two categories of people. One is those who have been convicted of misdemeanor crimes, and there are certain requirements that I can detail later about what that means. And the other is the category of people who are subject, while they are subject, to a restraining order that has been served. There's been an opportunity to be heard. There was notice, actual notice, and an opportunity to appear at a hearing. And after a hearing, the judge determined that the restraining order was to be upheld. And then the federal prohibition currently applies, and this state law would mirror that application. Okay. And to get to your question, Representative Chair Barker, you asked, when the order is in effect, how does it come out of the record? And there are two ways. One is that when the order is entered into the record, it has an expiration date. After the order has been upheld after a hearing, it's good for 1 year from the date of initial issuance. So that expiration date is entered into the system, and it automatically is removed from the system at 11:59 p.m. Some people have chosen to do it at 12:01 a.m. just to make sure that it gets all the way through the end of the day, but that it comes automatically out of the system at that point. If a judge, for whatever reason, terminates an order prior to that automatic expiration, the statute in 107.720 sub 3, I believe, requires that the court immediately forward that information to the sheriff, and the sheriff must immediately remove the record from the system. So that's how that is managed.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Leininger.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your work on this bill, all three of you and others in the room. I think that's really important, and I very much appreciate the teamwork that has gone into making it possible for this to be a bipartisan bill that has the neutrality of some organizations that care very much about reasonable access to firearms. Ms. Hebb, I'm wondering if you could speak to the value added of having this bill be brought, having this passed as a state law to complement the fact that there is federal law on the issue. I believe that you shared with me at one point that it makes it easier for state law enforcement to enforce and respond to these situations to have it be in state statute. Can you speak to that, please?
Absolutely, Chair Barker and Representative Leininger and members of the committee. I echo and will expand upon some of the comments that the Attorney General made, which is that there are, I believe at last count, 14 approximately federal ATF agents in the state of Oregon. There are certain circumstances, as I understand it, very limited ones, in which local law enforcement officers can be cross-deputized to enforce federal law, but it is not the norm. And so in our experiences, and I am sure in all of your experiences, the folks who are in our communities responding to 911 calls and on our streets and working hard to keep our citizens safe, in addition to that team of federal agents, the folks who are across the state in cities and towns, those are local law enforcement officers. And our local law enforcement officers, without the passage of this bill, which provides a state statute, they do not have the authority to enforce the federal law. They can call the feds, and many do. But the capacity and the to respond is especially on an immediate basis in the midst of a crisis is not there. So I think that's why the studies show that states that have taken steps to pass these state statutes have seen success and have seen a reduction in firearm violence.
Did you mention this?
Any further questions, yeah. Representative?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me, when a judge issues a restraining order, does he or she typically inquire about the presence of firearms?
Chair Barker.
And ask for them to be surrendered as a part of that?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, this gets at another question, which is, does this law, passage of this law, impose a duty of dispossession or seizure on local law enforcement? And it does not. What the bill does is amend our current Chapter 166 list of people who are prohibited possessors of firearms. We're all familiar with the term felon in possession. That's a crime under Oregon statute in Chapter 166. There are a couple of other categories of people who are identified in that statute as also being prohibited from possessing firearms for whatever those reasons are. This bill will add two categories: people who've been convicted of misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, or people who are subject to the qualifying restraining orders. And so it's just creating those two crimes to mirror the ones that exist in the federal law. And all that does is give law enforcement the capacity, if they have probable cause to believe that that law has been violated, they can act accordingly, just as they do now when they have probable cause to believe, for example, that someone is a felon in possession contrary to the law, and as they have the capacity to enforce other of our criminal statutes. So there's no, once this passes, there's a sweeping into the communities or that sort of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been wrestling with this bill a lot from a standpoint of how it will actually work, if it will actually work, from a very practical standpoint. So as I think this through, first of all, you have an order saying you can't have contact with that person, with the victim, and that happens oftentimes. And if my memory serves, I think on more than one occasions, back in my history bank, judges have said, and take those firearms, and so they're taken by order of a judge, an Oregon judge, so they can be seized at that point. So there exists a method to do that right now. So I'm thinking two points, and I don't know, maybe Representative Peluso, you can give me the greatest context to this. I'm thinking of two particular scenarios, one of which the order is issued, you can't contact this partner, a stalking order, intimidation, molesting, anything like that. And so now we call local law enforcement and say, go to the house and take the guns, which is a pretty easy thing if the victim's the one staying in the house. If it's not, you have somebody else, and oh my gosh, I cannot think of a more potentially volatile situation than that. And I keep reminding myself, this is a seizure of guns that belong to the victim, or to the suspect. No other guns. No other guns. So there's still access to firearms. They're just not access to their firearms. Talk to me a little bit about that, and then I'm thinking back of the many women, unfortunately, that continued to live in that cycle of abuse, and continued to go back to the abuser and, frankly, violate the order as often as the offender did. So help me understand that a little bit, because first, I think that I know the authority already lies there, and judges have said seize guns, and that can be done. And second, it doesn't stop access to any other weapons, especially strangulation, which has a higher incidence.
Chair Barker and Representative Springer, I can just go back to what my experience was in law enforcement. Anytime we investigated a domestic violence-related case, we asked for permission to take the guns for safekeeping. Yep. And frequently that worked in our favor. It didn't always. The process of accessing a judge to get that order to have that released would take time, but that again, occasionally would work in our favor. Anything we could do creatively within the law was really our most effective tools. And I like to think that it worked. I just feel strongly that every time we took one away, we saved a life. We took those sorts of choices away from people. The restraining order issue, I got to tell you, the dynamic of domestic violence, and I can turn to some experts in the room. So I've been retired 6 years, so it's been a little while, but we know statistically that a woman will report or at least attempt to report 10 times before actually leaving. I mean, the dynamics of domestic violence goes far deeper than a simple, okay, it's time to leave. And I share the story frequently when I talk about my career that really what got me hooked on this was I was a brand new college graduate, I was a police officer, and I felt I was pretty doggone smart and sharp. And when I said to a woman, so why don't you just leave, and looked right in my face and said, you don't understand, I can't. And she was absolutely right. It was not a part of what my world or my experience. And that's really what's got me started on this, is that we have to give our victims, and we can't ignore the new dynamic. Well, actually, it's not that new, but when we're dealing with same-sex situations and those sorts of things, there's that dynamic exists in so many scenarios of how we support the victims in becoming survivors is by letting them have the opportunity to make their choices. The dynamic that makes us cops is power and control, which is the same thing that makes a batterer a batterer. So we had to really change the culture of law enforcement in order to work towards breaking that cycle. And it's not a one-size-fits-all, which what makes it so difficult.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you for that. And I just want to clarify, the passage of this law, if I understand it as I read it, will not expedite the process of seizing those guns. I mean, it won't happen on the spot with this law. Is that correct?
So, Chair Barker, Representative Springer, and members of the committee, so I think one of the things that you're asking about is there underlying authority for a judge as a term of a restraining order to address guns? And I think that is something that, so this bill doesn't affect that at all, doesn't have anything to do with that. And that is a process that is used in some communities and not in others, by some judges and not others. It's not a uniform statutory provision. What this bill does, since it creates a state statute that creates a crime of possession in certain circumstances, again, that mirrors the federal law already on this topic. What it does is it allows law enforcement officers and our state prosecutors, and that's another thing I wanted to mention, is that not only does this allow state law enforcement officers to do that implementation, it allows state prosecutors to bring charges, and they cannot do that at all right now. They do not have the authority under the state statute to do that. And so how that helps in the immediate circumstance is, for example, imagine a law enforcement officer responding to a 911 call, and imagine that upon arrival, there are guns in the home. Maybe they're plainly evident. Before walking into that home, law enforcement officer, if they have the time and capacity and routinely, will do a background check or, you know, just run a record check on that person. If it pops up that the state has already issued a restraining order that's been upheld after a hearing or has convicted this person previously of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, there will be a flag in the record that indicates that, which then puts the law enforcement officer on notice. This person's got that history. It's a history that's got gun implications, and it then lets me know I have the authority now, because that firearm there is evidence that there's been a violation. I now have the capacity to do something about that, where I might not have otherwise. And so that's how it helps from our perspective, law enforcement as well as victims.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I don't think I was very clear in my question, because I heard you want to get those guns out as soon as possible. This law does not, the first time you respond and it's domestic violence, this law in and of itself does not allow for the instantaneous seizure of weapons.
Unless
there's no restraining order yet issued.
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, unless we can show that it was used in the committing of a crime.
Which is another way to seize them.
Correct.
But not this bill.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Over here.
Representative Reed.
You get the restraining order as a result of the judge having received information. He sees it. He thinks it's justified, so he issues a restraining order. Then later, I believe one of you said they could get the guns back later. Well, my question is, wouldn't it be better to have some type of counseling or services regarding drugs or violence or something before they got them back? And there's nothing in this bill that makes any type of counseling that they've received any type of services regarding family, and you're putting the woman back in the home with the same guy, and she could have, they could have the guns, but they've received no type of training or services about domestic violence.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, members of the committee, I think so the bill simply makes it a crime for possession during certain circumstances. One of those is during the existence of a restraining order that's qualifying. If there's a continuing danger, the petitioner has the right under Oregon statute to petition for a renewal of a restraining order if there's good cause shown and the judge makes a determination to continue that. So if there's continuing danger, that's one of the circumstances. But the other is just it allows the victim the time and space during the restraining order to make safety steps and to move forward. And so this statute would apply really the same way that it applies, for example, under current law to those who have been convicted of felony crimes, for example. It would make it consistent with that application.
It would just seem like it would be make sense before you're going to get them back. The judge would say, hey, you go get some counseling, come back and show me that you've got it. Then you can get your guns back.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I love your idea. However, in this particular bill, we have not included that as long as the restraining order is not in effect any longer and there hasn't been an attempt to renew it. That's not included here, but I'd sure love to talk to you about other ways in which we can ensure that that counseling does take place. And certainly if a person is charged with a crime, then there are many opportunities to make that a part of, for example, a probationary sentence.
Questions? Okay. Thank you, panel, and thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I keep coming back to, I'm having a hard time still wrapping my mind around enforceability. This weekend, I think it was last Thursday, in one day, there were 6 shootings in Northeast Portland. On Saturday or Sunday here in Salem, we had 2 shootings. All of them could have been domestic violence situations. As far as I know, I don't know the story. I wasn't there. I'm not the officer. I'm just reading what I saw in the newspaper. I still can't get to the where, how do we? This bill doesn't stop anything, really. And the second part that I would add to that is what if the person doesn't show up to the hearing? Can that person's guns be seized under this bill?
So. Chair Barker and Representative Post, so the federal law is very explicit on when it is that the restraining order prohibition applies, and this bill mirrors that application. So in order for the application to or the prohibition to apply, there needs to have been an order that was issued by a judge, served upon the respondent. The respondent requested a hearing. There was a hearing. The respondent got actual notice of that hearing date. There was a hearing held, and the judge continued the order after the hearing. So those are the only circumstances in which the order can will trigger, if you will, a firearm prohibition. And that's, again, an exact mirror of the federal application.
And if I might, Chair Barker, Representative Post, in response to your question about enforcement, currently we have 14 federal law enforcement officers who do make an effort to enforce this law federally. The problem is that's only 14 law enforcement officers throughout the entire state. This law, if enacted, would allow for all local law enforcement officers to be able to enhance that work that our federal officers are currently doing, and it would also allow district attorneys to bring charges against those who would violate this law. None of that is currently possible.
Okay, thank you, panel, and thank you, Representative Peluso, especially for having to go back and relive that and dump your neural adrenaline one more time.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Aaron Greenwald, Steve Belshaw, and Patrick Moore.
Ladies first.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Erin Greenewald. I'm the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor for the Oregon Department of Justice. Prior to coming to the Department of Justice, I was a line prosecutor doing domestic violence and person felonies in Yamhill and Marion County. I've been doing domestic violence prosecution for over 16 years. In addition, I'm also the co-chair of the statewide domestic fatality review team. We review at least two cases every year. We write and submit reports. I believe you received at least one of those reports that we submitted earlier this year. I would reiterate the testimony and echo the testimony that you've already heard. I've submitted written testimony. I'm not going to reiterate what I had written there, but I just wanted to hit upon, I think, three points that are really important. The first is how important this bill and this law would be for local law enforcement and local prosecutors to be able to do their job. Part of what I do in my position is I provide technical assistance and training to law enforcement, prosecutors, advocates, and other professionals who work with and within the criminal justice system. And over the course of that, we have provided training to prosecutors and hundreds of law enforcement officers about dispossession of firearms and how important it is. The problem in that training is that we've not had the tools to give law enforcement and prosecutors to be able to do that. So essentially what we've been able or trying to do is give them an awareness of how serious the situation is and then provide them the information so that they could call the ATF or their federal counterparts to do something about it. So we've heard the statistic, we've heard the numbers that there are 14 ATF officers for their entire state of Oregon. There are only really three U.S. attorneys, assistant U.S. attorneys, who specialize in gun and domestic violence prosecutions. So we have about 350 local prosecutors in this state who potentially could be doing these cases, and we have three U.S. attorneys who technically are tasked with doing these cases. So there are very few, if any, cases, because of resource allocation, that are actually taken by the U.S. Attorney's Office from local prosecutors who I speak to and email with on a regular basis, who I know are seeing these cases and would like to do something about it, but just simply are not able to because we don't have a state law to be able to enforce. The other thing that was touched upon, and I know Officer Moore is going to touch upon this too, is the danger to law enforcement when you have domestic violence and you have firearms. And you've heard Representative Peluso talk about how domestic violence and guns is one of the most dangerous situations for law enforcement. One of you had mentioned the statistics and how important they are. From 1996 to 2009, 106 officers were killed responding to domestic violence calls nationally. 97% of them were murdered with a firearm. Here in Oregon, and I'm sure you all remember in 2013, Officer Robert Libke was killed responding to a domestic violence incident. That perpetrator had a restraining order against him and had a history of violence. You can simply Google, as I sometimes do for my trainings, SWAT callouts or CERT callouts in Oregon, and you'll find just even in recent months all over the state where our SWAT teams have been called out and they've had to shoot or have been shot at by perpetrators of domestic violence who have firearms in their possession. But it's not just about the death, and I believe that Attorney General Rosenblum mentioned this. It's also about the significance of what a firearm means when it's inside the house where there's domestic violence. And statistics and research has borne out that the most severe abuse against domestic violence victims happens when there is access or possession to a firearm. It's all about the pattern and the dynamics of domestic violence. So there are lots and lots of reasons, and you've heard a lot of them, and you're going to hear even more as other witnesses get up, about why this bill is so important. So I just would urge your support of SB 525B. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Moore. I'm a lieutenant with the City of Roseburg Police Department. Also, our other partner, Deputy Chief Steve Belshaw, is in court. He sends his apologies. He submitted his written testimony. I believe I have his proxy, as we've worked together on quite a bit of projects. I don't believe he'd disagree with my testimony either. I will be succinct, as most of my testimony would at this point be redundant. However, just three real succinct and relevant points. Number one, as you've heard already today, there's no substantive reason not to be consistent with federal law on this point. Domestic violence is, by an overwhelming majority, the purview of state and local law enforcement. Number two, studies on crossover offending have shown us that the people to whom the defendants and other suspects to whom this bill, this law would apply, are the most violent among us. The crossover offending into from spousal abuse to child abuse to elder abuse and all the way to up to and including rape, they are often the same offenders. This is an early identification of the people with the highest propensity for violence. And that extends even more so when a restraining order is in play, because that is when emotions run the highest. Number three, as has already been testified to, the number of standoffs, the hostage situations, those kinds of incidents. I was our commander of our tactical team for 14 and a half years, and I can only count a handful of times in which those incidents did not originate from an incident of domestic violence. And the vast majority of those were, of course, with a firearm. And with that, I'm happy to address any questions that the committee may have.
Any questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lane Downing and Nikki Terizoff. Said that wrong, as usual. Common spelling, I know.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. For the record, my name is Jane Downing, and I'm the director of the Center for Hope and Safety that serves Marion County for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 525B. You've talked a lot today about statistics and all those different things, and I kind of want to give you a boots-on-the-ground kind of feel. Every single day, we hear from victims and survivors who say, I've been threatened with a gun. I'm afraid of when it's going to be used against me. And one of the things that I've heard what all of you have said about, but what about this and what about that piece of it and how does this protect folks? You have to look at the big picture of this is part of a coordinated community response to domestic violence that says we're going to do this piece here that helps some and we're going to do this piece here that helps some. And altogether, it makes a difference for victims and survivors. If you say to a perpetrator, you can't have these guns. Could they possibly get another gun? You bet. None of us are kidding ourselves to think that could happen. But if you give them a window of time that they know that there isn't a gun that's going to threaten them, think of the decisions they might be able to make because they know that they're a little bit safer during that time. Every year, we see the input that happens from victims when they're threatened with guns day in, day out. Think of someone sitting for hours cleaning that gun in front of them, and they know exactly what that means for them. And then this bill says, we're going to say to those folks, you don't get to have that gun, and we're going to take steps to be able to take that away from them. That might save someone's life. And I believe that it can. And so I really want to encourage you to take that next step of saying, this is one more piece where we're saying to perpetrators, it's not okay what you're doing in your home. And we're going to help the victims and survivors and their children that have to live with this every single day. So thank you so much for your consideration. Please support this bill.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and I wish I either went first or had a green button in front of me because I would push it after that, Jane. Thank you. Jane and a lot of the lifesavers around the state are who we represent at the coalition. We're a statewide organization that provides technical assistance and advocacy and training for programs such as Jane's, the Center for Hope and Safety, as well as programs across the state in every district. And now, thanks to work that this body did a couple of years ago, also on tribal lands, on tribal reservations, which is very important. I'll just add a me too for the coalition's perspective on here. We know that even if one life is saved, that's one more life that needs to be saved, that deserves to be saved. I'll also add very quickly a we too, if you will. You've received on OLIS, on public record, a series of letters of support and statements of support. There's a group of DAs, there's a Washington County Circuit judge, a handful of law enforcement representatives. You'll also see some of the programs that the coalition represents from around the state have submitted testimony. The coalition, the Alliance to End Violence Against Women, the Nurses Association, a handful of doctors. The list goes on, and it's really because I think what Ms. Downing was saying was right, is that if this is one piece of a larger puzzle that's going to help somebody, and in particular, chances are, because we know 50% of the cases of domestic violence, children are there and children witness, it will help somebody plus one or plus two. So urging your support for 525B, this, I think, has been a well-negotiated bill and has gotten to this point, and I'll hope that we can get it one more step through.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Sterrett, please.
Good afternoon, Kevin Sterrett with Oregon Firearms Federation. You know, we didn't testify on this bill on the other side because some of what we thought were the worst elements of it were taken out. But after having had an opportunity to read and listen to most of the testimony, and many of the issues were repeated, I really felt I had to make some comments. One of the things that I'm a little confused about is there were several references made to violence that happens with a person who's a perpetrator, a domestic violence abuser, who's in the home. You know, since 1997, people who are convicted of domestic violence have been prohibited under federal law from owning a firearm or a single round of ammunition for the rest of their lives, no matter how insignificant their alleged transgressions were. And this even applies to people who were convinced to plead to domestic violence misdemeanor years before that law even took effect. And so it's hard for me to really understand what the purpose of this is. We've already taken away the rights to have firearms and ammunition forever. And these people, particularly the people prior to the passage of the Lautenberg Act in 97, had no idea what they were going to lose in the future when they were convinced to plead to a misdemeanor. And I will tell you, I've had personal experience with people who were involved in incidents that really weren't domestic violence at all. They were misunderstandings on the part of arriving police when a person suffered a medical issue. And they were convinced to cop a plea to a domestic violence misdemeanor because they were told that basically this would save them thousands of dollars in legal fees, but never told what they were giving up. Now, in Oregon, that's no longer possible. In Oregon, you must be told you will give up your firearms rights for life if you plead to domestic violence. But it's really troubling how much people have lost over these things. But here's the other thing one of the things I really felt I had to respond to. You've been told, and it's been repeated by virtually every single proponent of this bill, from legislators to DAs to our own attorney general, that Oregon police are not allowed to enforce this law. And you know, I heard this in the beginning, and so I really was, I mean, it's compelling, it's disturbing, but I also think it's totally false. I mean, there's nothing in our statutes that prevents an Oregon police officer from enforcing that law or any other law, and this has been reaffirmed by our own Supreme Court recently in Willis versus Winters, where they said specifically, the sheriffs are authorized to enforce federal as well as state law, and no state law prohibits the sheriffs from taking such enforcement actions. And so I think all of us would agree that any kind of violence is a bad thing. I also think it's important when we look at what we've been told about the necessity for this law that we take that into consideration when we try to assess the accuracy of everything else that we've been told. And you know, what we're being told, of course, is that there's epidemics of everything and there are loopholes everywhere. But I just think that what we're getting to the point now where the original version of this bill made virtually everything domestic violence. And I think, unfortunately, that kind of belittles the genuine incidents where people really are in danger and really are hurt. And if somebody is an abuser, there are remedies for that. And if they're a domestic violence abuser, they're not allowed to have guns to begin with. And if they've committed assaults or other crimes, there are remedies to address that. So I just wanted to be on record as saying that I think it's fairly clear from our statutes and from the Supreme Court's own decision that it's inaccurate to say that our police can't enforce these laws.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, at the beginning, Kevin, you said something about, and I tried to write it down. I didn't catch, who said it, that if you were convicted of domestic violence, you couldn't have a gun or ammunition for life?
Frank the Lautenberg Act in 1997, and that applies to police officers. I know a sheriff's deputy in Washington County who was convicted of nothing. He did have a restraining order against him, and I think he fairly well convinced me that the restraining order was unjustified. Obviously, I can't prove that, but the judge made no guns an element of his restraining order, which meant, of course, that he lost his job, too.
Okay, and then follow up to that. ORS 133.310 and its relationship or not to Willis versus Winters. I think you talked about Willis versus Winters. So we have current statute that addresses this, right?
Yes, it says you have the authority to arrest for a felony, a misdemeanor, an unclassified offense for which the maximum penalty allowed by law is equal to or greater than the maximum penalty allowed for a Class C misdemeanor and any other crime committed in the officer's presence.
Okay, so English, that means?
So, listen, when I first heard these assertions that only these 14 ATF agents could arrest a person who was committing a crime, that didn't sound right to me, so I took it up with three of our attorneys, and all of them immediately pointed to that statute and the Winters versus Willis Supreme Court case.
And I would just say some of these cases where somebody hasn't been arrested and there's an application for a restraining order, the person might not even be there, and then the person has a chance to come back. So that's a little different. And there were instances I can recall where I think it had more to do with the immigration stuff where we would have to call the feds and they would say, we don't care, don't hold them. And that people were in violation of federal law, but they weren't interested. The feds just weren't interested. Now, on the domestic violence pieces, I believe, like I just said, there wouldn't have to be an arrest first, and then you'd have the hearing. Presumably, the woman goes to get a restraining order, could be a man, and says, this guy's threatened me or gal's threatened me with a gun. I need some help here. The judge then issues restraining order, has the person an opportunity to have a hearing to either deny or confirm it. If they issued a restraining order, then the judge would say, you can't have your firearms, give them to your brother or whatever, get them out of the house for the time being.
Right. Well, Chair Barker, the problem with that is something I've brought up in the past, is that typically what happens in these situations, and unfortunately people who have had these occur to them, those are the kind of people who contact me, a person requests a restraining order. And that restraining order is not an accusation or even not a conviction or even an accusation of an actual crime, because if that were the case, there could be an arrest and there could be a trial. But if a restraining order is issued and a person says, wait a minute, none of this is true, I want to clear my name, what happens in many of these cases is there is a hearing. If he's had an opportunity for a hearing and the order is continued, he automatically loses his guns. And the problem in many of the cases is that a person goes to contest a restraining order. And the judge says, okay, do you plan on following her around? Well, no, Your Honor. Are you going to harass her? No. Are you going to assault her? No, of course not. Well, then you'll have no trouble complying with this restraining order, and it's upheld. But now, as a result of having had the opportunity to appear before the judge, federal law no longer makes it a possibility. It makes it absolutely mandatory that that person's firearms are removed. And what I have to wonder about is, What are the possibilities that a really dangerous, violent person is going to be dissuaded? There's not an issue that we hear. There's not a gun control bill where somebody doesn't say if just one life is saved. And, of course, that's a great thing to say because you never have to demonstrate that you saved any life. And you never have to really talk about the cost to people who really haven't done anything wrong because of this potential life that we never have to demonstrate was saved. But the problem with restraining orders is that people very often, judges have the power. There's the clause in the law that says they have the power to do anything else they want to do. They take away people's property in the absence of a person having been convicted or accused of a crime. And in this case, my biggest concern is just that, as I said, I started looking at this, and there was nothing to indicate that every police officer in Oregon is empowered to arrest somebody for a federal crime.
Any questions? Any further questions for Mr. Sterrett? Thank you, Mr. Sterrett, for your testimony. Sybil Hibden, do you want to come back up? I got a note saying you did.
Only if there are questions, Your Honor.
Wow. You may approach the bench. Are there any questions? Okay.
It's been a long time.
I guess not. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet.
So we're ready to move at the main
Yes, we will go into a work session on Senate Bill 525.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 525 be engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 525 be engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Real quick.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
The dash B6. I read it this afternoon, and I don't. Are we just? That's just.
Not part of my motion.
I didn't think it was. So okay, that's why I wanted to make sure. So.
Chair Barker and Representative Post, the dash B6 was meant to resolve a potential conflict with House Bill 2429. However, that sort of thing, we've talked to LC, can be resolved on the back end as well. So,
yeah, and it's my desire to move the bill or not today.
Okay.
We have a motion before us to move Senate Bill 525B as engrossed to the floor to do pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Greenlick?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Post?
No.
Representative Springer? Representative Springer?
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you said Greenlick. No.
Vice Chair Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Yes.
Chair Barton?
Yes. Motion carries. Will Representative Paluso be the carrier, please? Thank you.
We should close the work session.
Okay, the work, yeah. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 173.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 173 authorizes a person who is licensed with a concealed carry permit to present a valid concealed carry license to a peace officer in lieu of presenting the firearm for inspection. We are considering the proposed Dash 1 amendment, which removes the portions of ORS 166380 stating that failure to present a concealed handgun license or a firearm for inspection upon a peace officer request constitutes reason to believe that person has committed a crime. The bill with the Dash 1 amendments is ready to move with no fiscal and no revenue impact.
Okay. Kevin Sterrett and I think it's John I'm not sure.
Okay.
That's the one.
For the record, Kevin Sterrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. Chair Barker, I did not see the amendments that I assume if those if those are adopted, that will address the concerns we have. I mean, I really believe that creating a situation where someone can demand ID from you in the absence of any kind of suspicion of a crime is probably a constitutional issue. But if you adopt those amendments, I think that will.
I expect we will.
Yeah.
Or I won't vote for the bill.
Okay.
Please.
Having listened to all the previous ones, I didn't volunteer as a citizen.
I need your name.
My name is John Lloyd Scarf.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm a retired correctional officer. Done a lot of searches of people and places and things, and I was really astounded by that previous testimony. He said that they were just going to go into a house and start searching. I think you could do that for days and still not find a firearm that was present. When you pull me over and you decide you want to search me because you think I may have a weapon, you really are putting me at risk, not the officer, because the officer we already know is armed. He's actually got the authority to shoot me. He can do it with the intent to kill me, and they usually have the intent. They point at center mass. They're not pointing at your foot. They're not pointing at your belly button. They are a paid killer. That's what they do. We have a lot of really guys worth respecting because they get themselves searched every day. They get their background checked all the time. And just as I did when I went to get my CHL. When I came in here, I showed him my CHL. If he wanted to see my weapon, he could, but it would have been a risk to our public safety. Okay? But I don't see that this bill will stop him from demanding to see my firearm because he goes, I think maybe your firearm is not your firearm, therefore I want to see the serial number that's on the firearm. That puts me in the position of having to show my serial number now, and that means that you have violated my Fourth Amendment because that's an unreasonable search. Okay? So every time you do this, the law itself, without changing it, is dangerous. But even if you do change it, it's not going to make it less dangerous. It's not going to change any of the behaviors on the part of the police. It's going to remain the same. And the police don't have to remember every one of these laws either. Recent case was for you and me, if we go to do something and we are in violation of law, we don't have an excuse. It's our job to know the law. But bizarre enough, police officer doesn't have to do that. If a police officer pulls you over and he said he pulled you over because one of your brake lights wasn't working, and the state says you only need one that works, he is still covered, even though he didn't know that you were actually legal about what you were doing. So they're under a completely different law than I am, which it shouldn't be. Shouldn't be. Right here in Oregon Constitution, equality of privileges and immunity of citizens. No law shall be passed granting any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities upon which the same term shall not equally belong to all citizens. When you take me and say I've got to pay for the right to carry a firearm, you just put an extra burden on me. When you make me stick my fingerprints out and you start checking to see where I've been for the last 40, 60 years, you are getting into my area of privacy. You are making an extra burden on me every time you make that decision to check me. And under Terry, just any kind of excuse can be made. It's the totality of the issue that's involved. And I can make up stuff. They say, no, you can't. You have to have a reasonable suspicion. But you can't argue with the officer out on the street what is reasonable. You don't get that choice. And once you pull that weapon out, once he touches my weapon, I can't be absolutely sure that he hasn't disabled my weapon. Once you let somebody else touch your weapon, you can't be sure, absolutely. You have to tear it down, take a look at it, to be absolutely sure that it's still functional. That may be paranoid. Of course it is. But it's also reasonable for you to worry about that and check your weapon later on. That makes another burden for me to make sure that that weapon has not been tampered with. And when you pull me over and you tell me I have to talk to you, you're taking my time. And under the Oregon Constitution, if you take my time, then I have a reasonable expectation that you will pay me for my time. And my time is worth serious money. If I have to instruct an officer on the details of...
You take civil. You go to civil court if you feel you've been, if they've...
I will.
Okay.
What I'm saying is in the process, now we've burdened me extra, and you've also endangered my life by taking a weapon out of my hands. And any idiot that's around me could also take that weapon. And believe me, my weapon is already...
We're getting off course, right. So we need to bring it back. But I appreciate your...
Right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing, open work session on Senate Bill 173.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 173.
Representative Williamson moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 173. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 173 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 173 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Olson will be the carrier.
Okay, thank you.
And open a public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 391A.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill.
We don't have a public hearing, it's just a work session.
Oh, I'm sorry, thank you. We're open a work session on Senate Bill 391.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 391A. Prohibits the seizure of a deposit for security release in a criminal case without obtaining a search warrant or court order. It requires a court order for the transfer or distribution of property after a seizure and states that a person designated by the magistrate to accept security in a criminal case acts as the agent of the court for that purpose. The bill requires the court clerk to accept security during normal business hours and specifies that security may be posted in the form of cash, cashier's check, credit card, or money order. The A in gross that came over from the Senate side is ready to move with a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact.
Chairman, Senate Bill.
Discussion first, if anybody has any. I know that there was some discussion and there's about keeping the 48-hour rule, and there is still ways that I think that money, if there is probable cause to show that it's illegal gains, that can be sought, we can go after it. But I talked to as you know, the last time I was ready to move the dash four amendments, I've since talked to a jurist who I have a great deal of respect for, and she told me that she thought that would be a bad idea, and she asked that we move it this way, and that's my inclination today.
Okay.
Yeah, so
Representative Martin?
Right. Defer to the Vice Chair. Chair Barker, I wanted to thank you and acknowledge this is... We all love serving on your committee, and this is, you wanted to move the dash fours. We would have voted for it. Probably, I think a majority of this committee preferred it as is. I think many chairs would have just go ahead and called the question on the dash fours the other day. But I really appreciate the way you let the committee have its voice. Thank you. Yeah, not many chairs would have done that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I understand what the base bill is all about, and I get, I still refer back to the testimony that Gail Myers had shared with us, and my thought on civil asset forfeiture avenue as well. I struggle kind of on the face value of the bill. I was kind of hoping that maybe there was something else that we could get, but it just didn't surface. I mean, even with the dash fours, but, so I'm... Honestly, I'm really leaning toward voting no right now on this bill. So.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 391A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 391A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Greenland?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Coast?
I'm going to be an aye with just, I want to mention that I may be opposed.
That's
on
right.
The floor.
Thank you.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. So we may not have had the record on when we carried the bills over, so if we could go through those one more time, that would be great.
And just to, in case we didn't have it on the record before, we were carrying over Senate Bill 315, Senate Bill 641, Senate Bill 913.
I think you need a carrier for 391.
Yeah, the carrier on.
I can do it.
Representative Williamson will be the carrier on 391. Any further business to come before?
It's still tomorrow. Will you carry them over? You carry them over to tomorrow.
Yes. We need to wrap them up by Thursday, so rolling them down the hill.
Yep.
We're going to stand adjourned. Thank you. Thank you. We're going to stand adjourned.